I guess these three are coming up together. Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. We have three bills that are up for a public hearing and possible work sessions. We have Senator Richard Devlin here, our co-chair for Ways and Means, and because of that, we're going to start with Senate Bill 409. Shannon?
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 409 repeals the $500,000 cap on non-economic damage awards in tort actions. There are no amendments before you today. We do not have the fiscal back on this yet, so it's not ready to move.
All right. So, Richard, why don't you go ahead and come up, Senator Devlin, then we've got Patrick Block, I believe, and Art Towers. And Senator Devlin, regarding your schedule, did you want to give testimony and then take questions? Do you need to, or did you want to stand by while the others gave their testimony?
I can probably stay for the two others and see if there are any questions after that, but I'll probably have to leave by 8:30.
Okay, fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. I appreciate this opportunity. I am here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 409. Senate Bill 409 is important legislation to help families facing the worst possible tragedy, the death of a loved one. Hugo Avalos Channon worked for a cleaning company in the Portland area. On April 26, 2013, his company sent him to a meat processing plant in Clackamas County to clean out its industrial meat grinder. The meat processor had been cited in October 2012 by Bowie for failing to properly lock down the meat grinder during cleaning. The inspector said an unexpected startup of the machine could cause injuries. Just 6 months later, this is exactly what happened. Mr. Avalos Channon was pulled into the industrial grinder, legs first, and was killed. The death was especially painful based on the screams heard by his co-workers. The death was so grotesque that firefighters had to be called in the next day to help dismantle the machinery and extricate the remains. His family has filed suit against the meat processor for $5 million in non-economic damages. Under Oregon's civil procedure, a jury will hear the case and render a verdict, which is what we would expect. The jury can award the full $5 million, but the judge will be required, as a matter of law, to reduce that amount to a maximum of $500,000 for non-economic damages. The jury will not be told until after they bring a verdict that there is an arbitrary cap. All SB 409 does is remove the cap so juries can make realistic decisions about what families deserve in this sort of tragedy. The cap of $500,000 was put in place 28 years ago. Let me repeat that. The cap of $500,000 was put in place 28 years ago. No inflation adjustments have occurred to the cap, no adjustments of any kind in that 28 years. If this cap were simply adjusted for inflation, it would be slightly more than $1 million in 2014 dollars. 6 years ago, the House passed an increase in the cap to $1.5 million. That bill passed with only four no votes, but passed too late in the session to get consideration by the Senate. Ironically, we have another cap, which you all debated relatively recently. This is a cap for deaths that occur at the Oregon Health Sciences University. After much discussion, that cap was placed at $2 million. So in OHSU's case, if an identical case transpired at one of OHSU's competitors, the family would be limited to $500,000. But if it happened at OHSU, a quasi-public institution, it would be $2 million. I would urge you to pass Senate Bill 409 as is, or at the bare minimum, lift the outdated and outrageously low cap that has been in place for 28 years without a single adjustment. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I will wait for when you think it's appropriate for questions to be answered.
All right, thank you. If you've got the time, I'd like to take the other testimony, and then we'll open up the panel.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Block, and I'm a longtime member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 409. The current wrongful death cap, the statute that you're talking about, it currently only applies to wrongful death cases, and that cap sets up two classes of people. Those who earn income have value, and those who do not earn a paycheck have less value. The cap tells our elderly, our stay-at-home moms and dads, and those that are low wage earners that their lives have less value than those that are big wage earners, which isn't right. And I want to give you an example. In some of the testimony, written testimony that's been submitted to you, one of my colleagues, Jane Paulson, had a case involving a 74-year-old woman named Ruby Larson, who had dementia, and her children put her into a assisted living facility in Malala. And one of the problems she had is she would wander. So she'd wandered off four times, and the family was concerned about this. And so they went to the assisted living facility and said, we need to make sure that, Ruby doesn't wander off anymore. So we want you to make sure that you have appropriate staff to take care of that. And they assured her, or their family, that there was sufficient staff. She wandered off a fifth time and disappeared. And she ultimately froze to death, but they couldn't find her. And 3 years later, a little boy was looking for his cat, and in some bushes about a quarter mile from the facility, they found her bones in the bushes. The insurance carrier for the assisted living facility refused to pay anything significant, so the case went to trial. And the jury determined that the care facility was negligent and caused the death of Ruby, and they awarded $821,000. But that was all non-economic loss because she's retired and doesn't have any real economic loss. So after the verdict was taken, the judge then reduced it to $500,000. And the jury made a determination, and that determination they thought was fair. And unbeknownst to them, then the judge is forced to reduce it to $500,000. And that's just one example. Another thing I would like to point out is the voters in this state, over the last 15 years, there's been two measures to put caps on non-economic damages in civil cases, and the voters have voted no twice. So I think the constituents are saying caps are not appropriate in this state. As Senator Devlin said, the other point I would like to make is that there's a cap for public bodies, including the state of Oregon, and that's on all damages, but it's $2 million. And for one claimant, and if there's multiple claimants, which you usually have in a wrongful death case, because it's their family members, then it's $4 million. So setting the non-economic damages cap at $500,000 is just horrifically low, taking into consideration what even the state is saying is appropriate for the state's limits to be. So I urge your support of Senate Bill 409.
Art.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Arthur Towers, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. I think that the only two there's, I guess, three points I want to drive home. One is that there was bipartisan support for a significant increase 6 years ago, broad bipartisan support. But philosophically, we feel strongly that the right to a jury trial should be sacrosanct. The Seventh Amendment to the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right to trial by jury. And there's, you know, I've been before this committee several times this session, you know, working to protect that right. And I feel like this is yet another example of where that right becomes limited. The other piece that I wanted to add is that currently, if a person is injured but not killed, they can access much more funds. The cap doesn't exist in those cases. And for the insurer, for the people who are concerned about this, who have insurance, they're already insured against these injury cases already. And so we feel that bringing a measure of justice to the families of Ms. Larson and Mr. Avila Shannon and families like that across the state, you know, is a powerful and important step to take, given this set of circumstances. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions.
All right. Questions for the panel?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
So if somebody is injured, there's no cap at all, but if they're killed, there is a cap? Is that what I'm hearing?
That's correct.
And what was the policy reason back in 79 for doing that in the first place, for deaths and not injuries?
Go for it.
In 1987, the current statute applies a non-economic damages cap of $500,000 in any civil case. But the Oregon Supreme Court has held that in cases that involve injury but not death, which I can explain the legal process, that it's unconstitutional because under the Oregon Constitution, you have a right to trial by jury, which is inviolate, meaning that the jury makes the determination, and no judge or legislature has the right to reduce that in a case that doesn't involve wrongful death. But in a case that involves wrongful death, that's a statutory claim because of a long history of, at common law, there was not a claim for wrongful death, so the legislatures across the country made a statutory claim, and therefore the legislature in those statutory claims has the right to cap it at $3 if it chooses to. So legislatures need to figure out a reasonable sum, but that's why it doesn't apply to wrongful death cases.
Thank you.
Is that clear?
Yeah. Thank you.
All right, any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I have three other people that are scheduled, at least signed up on our list. I'm going to go ahead and call them up at this point, Jim Dorgan, Ann Bryant, and Jim Lace. While they're coming up, is there anyone else that's going to want to testify on Senate Bill 409? Good morning. Who would like to start?
Good morning. I'll start out. Senator Brzezinski, I'm Jim Dorgan, Regional Operating Officer for the Doctors Company. Doctors Company insures over 40% of the physicians in Oregon and has been providing insurance since the early 80s for physicians. One of the things that we're looking at here is, first of all, medical malpractice cases. Cases against healthcare providers, probably we're going to see more wrongful death cases than most other categories out there. The economic damages in those cases are all covered. There's no limitation under the current law for the cost of replacing services, medical expenses, future earnings. The current $500,000 cap provides a reasonable and fair amount for pain and suffering and emotional loss in wrongful death cases. In California, there's a $250,000 non-economic damage cap on all losses.
Jim, can I get you to just take the mic and drop it down a little bit, make sure.
In California, there's a $250,000 cap on all non-economic damages. And in 2014, the voters soundly rejected eliminating the cap. Oregon has had a stable market for insurance since the early 2000s. In 2000, when the non-economic cap for all cases was knocked out, there was a spike in claims filed and claims payments. It caused a rapid increase in premiums and the withdrawal of several insurers. Oregon now has a very stable environment. Claims frequency has decreased, and both the insurance companies and healthcare providers have invested heavily in patient safety. Currently, also, over 80% of claims against physicians are closed without payment other than the expensive cost of defending these cases. Eliminating the $500,000 cap on non-economic damages and wrongful death cases will create more costly litigation. There may be additional cases filed, and settlements will be more difficult to obtain with the potential unlimited damages. In the last session, the legislature addressed the issue of medical malpractice cases, and they set up early discussion and resolution, which has been in effect for less than a year. We need to give this legislation a chance to work without creating additional incentives for litigation. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and take the rest of the testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Oh, okay. Hi, my name is Ann Bryant, and I'm the Senior Director of Government Relations at Physicians Insurance, a mutual company. I am actually here filling in for Jeff Street. Jeff Street is our defense counsel, and he's unable to attend today. He is in a trial. He is an attorney in private practice, and he also sits on the Oregon Patient Safety Commission's Stakeholder Advisory Committee for the Early Discussions and Resolution Program. That's a program that I'm sure you're familiar with that was put into place, and we're all the medical malpractice carriers are working hard to make that system work. We urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 409. There are four reasons that he pointed out in his letter. I know you have a copy of the letter, and I ask you to read the letter and look through that for specifics. But just to kind of sum it up, the cap is we believe that the $500,000 cap on non-economic damages is fair. It again, as testimony has already been said, economic damages are completely, there is no limit on those, and are fully recoverable. It also allows for predictability, which is important when you're defending cases. So you can defend the cases, payment can go out faster, you can settle cases, and you don't get tied up in the court system where families aren't getting the money early and right away and on time because they're getting locked up in the trial system. I'm from Washington State. In Washington, we don't have a cap, and those cases are much harder to settle, take up a lot of time, a lot of expenses on both the plaintiff and the defense side. Finally, again, as Jim pointed out, the EDR program, you know, we're trying to make it work. It is a program for to get physicians and patients to be able to communicate and resolve in a timely manner adverse events. It's a great program. This does undermine it. People will not enter into the system if they have sort of an advantage to take their cases to court rather than work it through the system that we're trying to lower, you know, sort of claims and exposure and try to get people their money faster and really work on patient safety. So, again, we urge you to vote no on this. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jim Lace. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem. I've been a pediatrician for 38 years, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society, and I'm here to testify against Senate Bill 409 as it's currently written. I have been through multiple changes in our liability a practice that we have in the state. When I first started, you know, we changed, and then after the Lakin decision, we had the loss, you know, of our cap, and our insurance rates went up. We've had a disproportionate hit on physicians who choose to practice either in rural Oregon or choose to serve Oregonians who don't have access to care. And one of the things that we're concerned about with the current bill, the way it is that our rates will go up again, our predictability will go out, and we won't have that ability to control that. We realize that when we have a loss of a patient, it affects us, it affects the family, and we are sincerely involved with that grieving process. But to change the current system, which has been in place, I didn't realize for how long, it gives us predictability in terms of our insurance rates, and we want to ensure that we have physicians that will work with patients that have poor access to physicians, whether it's rural community, whether it's here in Salem, Oregon. And so we would vote against changing that. We like the predictability, and we like to be able to control our rates. We also would like to see how the EDR program plays out. That's one of the things y'all worked out last session, and we want to get that in place first and see how that is going to play out. So, but we're against it.
Okay. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
Could you please remind me what the EDR program is?
Early discussion and resolution.
For adverse
That's
events.
That's what it was.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I kind of remember
that. You remember that program?
I do, yeah.
We were slightly involved in that.
Yeah, I just want to make sure everyone understands what that actually is. So I guess the chair is going to ask a couple of questions. So, Jim, I listened to your testimony pretty...
Which Jim?
Lance, yes. You said as it's currently written. So why don't you tell me what you think is would be better written than what's currently written?
We'd have to take a look at that, see what is if there are some proposals to change that. And the question comes up, should you index this to cost of living? And we'd have to take that back into legal counsel and review that and say, what does that mean? How does that affect the insurance carriers and what, you know, going forward? And so that would be probably the only thing, the way I understand it, because remember, I'm just a doctor. Yeah. And I have to rely on the lawyers and all the people with brains to go through all this. But my understanding would be that you'd have to go back and review that and say, what are the implications? How does that affect our insurance market? How does that affect the availability of physicians in the state? So,
from an actuarial standpoint, a cap at $500,000 and above starts to become much less effective. In Montana and some other states, they've had a cap that's indexed, and basically what happens is you're back in a number of years discussing the same issue. So it does. For example, if this had indexed, as some of the prior testimonies had indicated, we'd be at over $1 million on a cap, and $1 million cap has no impact.
All right. So, but what I have heard from the testimony, it's been 28 years since we've really done anything with this. We had one chance, I guess, a couple, 5 years, 6 years back, where the House apparently passed one that actually moved it up a little closer to what inflation would be. Senator Devlin has testified that if just taking $2014 dollars, it'd be $1 million. And then so that's one point. I guess the other point is that we as a state have put a cap on for OHSU at $2 million. So now it sounds like we have a disparity between the facilities, if it's a public, a quasi-public versus a private, as it's an individual of means versus someone without means. It just seems like we need to do some adjustments here.
Well, the OHSU cap is different in that it's an absolute cap. It's a cap on both the economic and non-economic damages. So when you look at that as compared to a non-economic damage cap, there's a real difference. The other issue is that what we see in litigation is that huge prayers are put brought in as pressure to settle cases. Most physicians carry $1 million per occurrence, $3 million annual aggregate. So the demands in these cases would far exceed available insurance coverages and bring additional pressure on physicians and medical practitioners.
All right. So I understand from the perspective from this panel, the concern is for viability of having physicians in this state, and I appreciate that. But we've also had testimony that it's not just, you know, these cases where physicians are involved where there's a wrongful death. So how do we address that?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, what I'm hearing from this panel, the concern is because it sounds like the majority, or at least from your perspective, the testimony I heard says that the majority of these type of cases, wrongful death cases, involve physicians. I don't know if that's true or not, but what I do know is I've heard testimony of a gentleman who was basically lost his life, who was not being operated on. And so I'm trying to figure out how do we deal with that disparity.
Any comments?
Do we have other?
Well, the one difference is the pain and suffering, non-economic damages are awarded to the survivors and not the actual person that underwent that. And I'm recognizing there is a distinction, and there are some damages that are associated with the family in terms of grief and loss, but it's different than the economic damages awarded to the person who is actually surviving.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, kind of following along the same lines, if this hasn't been changed in 28 years and the original cap really doesn't seem to have caused any disruption in the insurance industry, then wouldn't it just make sense to do something like we did with OHSU to, I believe there was a transition period where it went in so it didn't all go in at once, but to But to get the cap up to kind of at least where it was when we first adopted it in 1978.
We have no limit on pain and suffering. You want to sue me for $40 million because I did something wrong, I operated on your wrong leg or whatever, there's no limit. What you did with OHSU, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that they had a really, really low system. Now they have a total of $2 million. There's no unlimited suit that you can bring against OHSU. You can't sue the king, as I understand it. So what you're doing here is that the pain and suffering, that was removed by the Supreme Court in the Lakin decision. So there's no limit on pain and suffering. So this is different. This is wrongful death. And you can say, well, and there's still the economic damages that they can recover. But what you're doing here, as I understand it, is that this is a cap on wrongful death. But what you did with OHSU is that there's a $2 million for everything.
Well, no, I'm getting that. I'm not comparing them to OHSU. I'm just saying that that was the system we used to bring up their cap. What I'm comparing it to is 1978. We had this cap in 1978. $500,000 meant a lot more then than it does now. So wouldn't it just make sense to bring it into the same proportion as we had in 1978 relative to the economy?
I guess my only comment there would be, and I completely respect what you're saying, I would look at California. They've had that cap at 250 for, is it 30 years?
1980s.
So I'm not good in math, but like 30 years. Yeah, so it's been a long time. And they've they just had a huge proposition to try to change that, and they've decided to keep the cap at the 250. So if you look at other states, I mean, some states have 350 caps, some have no cap. You know, it goes all over the place. So
I appreciate that. But get back to Oregon instead of California. We actually said we've had two votes to try to put caps in, and the citizens of this state have said no to that. So under that logic, we should maybe just take it off and just let it be uncontrolled. And I think what we're looking at is trying to see, is there some middle ground here? Some means of actually taking the dollars that were 1978 and at least bring them up to 2014. At least I'll just say that's where the chair is looking right now as a minimum of something, because it just seems to me after 28 years, maybe we need to make a little adjustment here.
The adjustment happens over time, and it's in economic damages. And so the compensation for everything that's real already exists in the system. This is on top of that compensation is what we're talking about. And I would also suggest, Mr. Chair, that we have a new process in place to try to get to a mediated settlement on some of these things. And I think that is relatively new, and I think we need to find out if or not that is going to be working before we do such a dramatic change to the system. Economic damages include lost wages, lost everything. I mean, that's already in the mix. So compensation is currently there.
For survivors.
The pain and suffering is on top of everything else, okay? And it's kind of a just because sort of thing. And I think we put a system in place. I think we need to allow it to actually start performing as we hope it will before we start looking at changing the system.
So Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question. I don't know if it's for the panel or for you. The prior panel mentioned parents that are primary caregivers. How is that? How is that considered in economic damages? So if I'm staying at home and caring for my children, but I don't have a wage, but it's very expensive for me to stay home and provide that care for my home, care for my children, how is that calculated in economic damages, or would that fall into the non-economic damages?
That would be the economic damages, and the cost of your services as a stay-at-home caretaker would be calculated and presented to the jury.
And then just a quick follow-up. What about the cost of counseling and care and psychological support for the children over the years of growing up, would that be considered economic or would that be considered non-economic?
Economic.
Yeah, economic.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Again, I'll ask, is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 409? Not seeing anyone standing up. We'll close the public hearing on 409. We're now going to, so we're going to go to Senate Bill 193. Shanna?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 193 modifies your advance directive statutes. As you know, advance directives are documents that provide health care instructions that take effect when you become incapacitated or incapable of giving other instructions. Right now, we use a statutory form. It's laid out in statute what needs to be contained in the form, how it's signed, what it looks like. This removes, Senate Bill 193 removes the statutory form for the advance directive, and it prohibits state agencies from prescribing the form or content of an advance directive. It provides guidance on the content that should be included, including the designation of the attorney in fact, that's the person who carries out your wishes, the designation of an alternative, healthcare instructions can be accepted in a form of a checklist, instructions on a healthcare form in the form of an explanation of religious beliefs, principles, or other guidances. It provides civil liability protections for those who authorize treatments not specifically mentioned in an advance directive if the basis for the decision is contained in the healthcare explanation. It would also require two signatures of two adult witnesses for effective execution of the advance directive. You have the proposed dash one amendments, which allow the advance directive to specify when such a document becomes effective. You also have the proposed dash two amendment, which restore the statutory form, but sunset it in 2018. It requires the Oregon Health Authority to adopt a new model form and puts together a rules advisory committee to do that.
All right, so I'm looking at the witness list and it looks like there's a group of four who want to come up together, so we'll need to bring another chair. So Gretchen, Angela, Dr. Woody, English, and Tom Holt. Good morning.
Good morning.
Who would like to be our lead witness?
I'll start.
Okay.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Gretchen Brower-Rieke. I came down from Milwaukee to speak in favor of Senate Bill 193. I'm a registered nurse and advanced care planning facilitator. I have a educational service in which I go around the state to different groups of people in different settings and help them think about and document and then discuss their wishes for end-of-life health care. So that's my work. That's what I do. I am working with people in the public on the ground around advance directives, pulsed forms, and all of that documentation that goes along with healthcare wishes. I wrote a book on this for Oregonians. And so this is my passion. This is what I do. What I've discovered over time is that Oregonians struggle mightily with our current advance directive. It was put into statute in 1992, and it was kind of a big step for that time. But since then, in the last couple of decades, things have changed, forms have changed, and it's become sort of a dinosaur. It's difficult, it's confusing for people, and it's very hard to fill out. And what happens then is when you have a form that you put in front of people that's this important, to have them trying to express what they do and don't want for their healthcare wishes at the end of life, and they don't know how to fill it out, they tend to toss it to the side. And when it's tossed to the side and they get to the end of their life, their healthcare professionals and their family don't know what they wanted, and they end up getting care that they didn't want, and everybody ends up suffering. This became even increasingly clear to me when I was asked to move up into doing classes in Southwest Washington. And so I sort of moved from doing Oregon forms to Washington forms. For example, in Washington, this very simple document called Five Wishes is legal. It's legal in 42 states. It is not legal in Oregon. I can put this in front of Washington residents, and they can take it home and fill it out easily without an hour of instruction. When I come back to Oregon, I have to spend an hour or more with groups walking step by step by step through our advance directive, trying to help them decipher what we mean here, what to put in those spots. It's just really tough. So I would strongly encourage you to move this out of statute so that people who are professionals in this field can work with it and make it more accessible, more user-friendly, so that people can actually engage it and use it, so we can increase the percentage of Oregonians who have completed advanced directives by the time the health crisis hits. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We'll take testimony and then questions after that.
Okay. Chair Pruszynski and members of the committee, my name is Angela Keenholz. I'm from Portland, and my business name is Departing Decisions. It's a publication that is distributed throughout Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties to over 20,000 residents a year, and it's on end-of-life planning. This was created because I've had personal experience with the advanced directive. My father had cancer, and the cancer had gotten to his brain, so we had to do his advance directive for him and make those end-of-life decisions for him. So 8 years ago, I had the personal experience with the advance directive, which is why now I'm making it my life's work to create a publication and advocate for end-of-life planning. So along with Gretchen, I also engage the public and have group workshops and community events around end-of-life planning and the advance directive. I've seen firsthand how complicated the forms are. Both Gretchen and I have somewhat created a cheat sheet to try to explain a little bit more about completing it, because when someone takes it home and tries to complete it after the workshops, most likely they don't, because it's just, they're unsure. And this is a form that's about life and death. And if people are not confident in the form that they're completing and the decisions that they're making through this legal form, they're not going to complete it, and we've seen that firsthand. So I emphasize that taking this out of statute and allowing the people in the community who are actively engaged with the public and in the medical community to collaborate and create a form that's up to date, that keeps us on the forefront of innovation with end of life and death care and aging, which the state of Oregon is doing, and I think that for us to be able to really create a forum that takes the beliefs and values into consideration for Oregonians is my belief.
Great, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
I will. Chairman Pruszynski and members of the committee, my name is Woodruff English, Woody English. I live in Portland. I'm a retired physician, still licensed to practice, although I've retired from clinical practice. I am board certified in internal medicine, in infectious diseases, and in a hospice and palliative care. I have three boards. I first came to Oregon in the 1970s as an epidemiologist for the Centers for Disease Control assigned to the Oregon Health Division. I've had extensive training in public health, as well as in change management, quality improvement, and healthcare. During my career, I was a primary care physician. I was a consultant for infectious diseases, and in that role, took care of many patients in critical care units, treating them for infections, which often was their penultimate medical condition before they died. In the late 1990s, I started a hospitalist program at Providence St. Vincent in Portland, and led that for 10 years, realizing eventually that the biggest problem with that kind of structure in healthcare is separating patients from the physicians who know them the most at the time they are most vulnerable and sickest. And then I changed my career to move into palliative care, because I was interested in being able to work with patients around creating appropriate care plans when they became seriously ill, and actually worked with an Oregon Community Foundation grant to promote the conversation, the goals of care conversation, which I've continued to do in my retirement. And now I work with the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and I'm co-chair of their Advanced Care Planning Committee. And in my work over the last 7 or 8 years in trying to promote conversations around goals of care, I have learned that we really need an appropriate vehicle for memorializing the decisions that people make and the struggles that they go through as they consider the conversation and what's important. And having worked at the other end in the hospital of knowing what's required at that end in terms of guidance for coming up with an appropriate care plan for patients. Out of this experience, then, I have become very interested in our Oregon Advanced Directive and understand its groundbreaking leadership, but the opportunities that now exist in revising it, because it is outdated, and it really doesn't serve us well as providers, and it doesn't serve our patients well either. So in my retirement, I've made contact with people through the Oregon Health Leadership Council in Southern Oregon and Medford. There's an organization called Choosing Options, Honoring Options, and members of that organization have testified before Senate Committee earlier this year to talk about the advance directive, and also in Central Oregon. So this has statewide energy. Currently, I've been working with people in Portland and in providing testimony here today. It's most convenient to have the Portland people here, but understand we represent people across the state in our passion to improve our current advance directive. What's difficult with the current advance directive is that it focuses too much on specific decisions that are made. And that's necessary, honestly, for educating people as to what to expect when they get into a complicated healthcare environment. But what the clinicians really need is to understand the destination of what a patient really wants out of life, what a person really wants out of life, which means that we need to memorialize not whether or not they want cardiopulmonary resuscitation or a feeding tube, but we really need to draw out of them their values and beliefs. What is their reason for living? Why is it important for me? So that in the very complex environment in the hospital where many things happen that weren't anticipated, we understand the destination of what we're trying to do for the patient. If I could come up with a metaphor, my metaphor would be a map, kind of on a GPS map. And if your instructions just said, go straight, take a right on Route 25, then turn left on River Road, and then the map gets changed because things change in the hospital and things don't always work out that way, what you really need is to know what the destination is and then be able to read the map as the map presents itself to you in order to do the best for the patient. And by focusing more on what patients really want out of life and creating for them a person who serves as their healthcare surrogate, the individual that we want to be able to speak for them when they no longer have capacity to speak for themselves, and to train that person really to understand the values and reasons for living that that person has, then we can use that living person speaking on behalf of the patient who can no longer talk to us to navigate this very complex and chaotic environment in the hospital to provide for them the best care. The PULSED, which has come up and is very helpful, does describe these exact concrete decisions around tube feedings and cardiopulmonary resuscitation, but is really designed for that part of life where an individual may have only 6 months or a year to live, more likely than not would be moving on to hospice, and things are moving close to the end. What we're doing now is having conversations with people sometimes a decade or more ahead of that. And in that environment, things are much more fluid, and we need a document that's much more flexible. So thank you very much for considering unlocking our current advance directive from statutory structure, defined structure, and allowing us to work on that in the field with our patients and with our providers to meet the current medical environment. Thank you for your attention.
Dr. English, could you just, for the record, describe what PULSE stands for?
It stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. It originated here in Oregon. It's groundbreaking. It has helped to give Oregon its reputation for being excellent in end-of-life care. It's absolutely fabulous, and all the other states, almost all of the other states, are now in the process of adopting it or have adopted it. And the vision is that in the future, this will be something that we do for everybody in our country.
Thank you, Tom.
Chair Prosansky and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. Our interest in this is that through our foundation, we've been very involved in end-of-life care and palliative care issues in the last several years, and we've been providing technical support for this discussion. And when this issue came up, I also had a personal interest, and so I was happy to lend a hand in that. Several years ago, I found myself on the receiving end of the Advanced Care Directive, and despite having worked in health policy for about 15 years at the time, I didn't make it through the whole form. I had to toss it aside, and we had to find some other documentation that could work for us at the time. What I'd like to do is just walk you through quickly what the Dash 2 amendments do and the approach that we're trying to take. The Dash 2s largely replaced the bill. The initial bill was ambitious. It was a repeal immediately of the statute, and that made a lot of people nervous, and we got some great feedback about that. And so what we've laid out, we think, is a more pragmatic approach. And what the Dash 2s would do is create a multidisciplinary process within the health authority to come up with model replacements for the statutory form, and it would create a rules advisory committee made up of clinicians, patient advocates, and legal experts. And that rules advisory committee would be permanent with the idea that over time, you know, this could be an iterative process and so more flexible than what we have now. The Dash 2 set a sunset date of January 1, 2018 on the existing Advanced Care Directive statute, so it creates a deadline for that work. It grandfathers all the existing Advanced Care Directives, so those who have gone through the planning don't have those plans disrupted. And the Rules Advisory Committee would need to complete its work by July of 2017 ahead of that sunset to provide, you know, at least a decent window for healthcare facilities to incorporate these into their medical records and things of that nature. It also does add to the attorney in fact piece of the Advanced Care Directive statute, an alternate attorney in fact. So if there is a second person who could become available to the clinician when someone is needed to be able to make to counsel on decisions when a person is unable to speak for themselves. So we're hopeful that by laying out a long timeline and a multidisciplinary process that we can get to a place where there are models that people can readily use. There is ample opportunity for the public and a wide range of experts to weigh in on what those model directives look like. And the legislature also, with that kind of timeline, would have the opportunity to tweak the process further if it came to light during that it was necessary. There'd be two sessions between now and that deadline. We've heard in our discussions in recent months, a wide range of people acknowledge that this is a problem, that it doesn't work well in practice. And frankly, I think we share the view that some have expressed that it's time to stop admiring the problem and launch toward work on a solution. We know that this bill with the Dash 2 is not quite finished. We got some great comments just yesterday from the Public Health Institute's Liz Baxter, technical suggestions that we welcome. We've had some really great conversations with a couple of people at the Bar Association in recent days. And we look forward to continuing those kinds of discussions. And we'll see how quickly we can get to a place where everyone's comfortable moving forward, whether it's in this session or in a subsequent session. We appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and to discuss this important issue. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much. So our next individual, Jessica, I'm going to ask you to go ahead and come up since you're four, and then we'll bring up the individual signed up as opponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jessica Adamson with Providence Health and Services, and we're here to testify in support of the bill and the Dash 2 amendment. Providence has a long history of working in palliative care, a lot of that work led by Dr. English when he was with Providence. We're very pleased to support a bill that would allow Oregon to continue to move forward in the practice of advanced care planning and certainly in the kind of end-of-life care that's so critical. Conversations around advanced care planning need to happen with everyone, and they need to happen before folks find themselves in a place where they're having to make difficult choices when they're ill. We believe that documents like Five Wishes enable folks to do that in a thoughtful way in advance of those decisions, and they're not faced with a form that sometimes leads to binary choices, yes or no on a ventilator. And for most people, it's not a yes or no answer. It's a it depends. And a form like the Five Wishes that allows patients to make those decisions in a way that is values-based, that's consumer-friendly. That's what we believe good advanced care planning looks like. Providence operates in five states. Washington is one of them, and our mission and ethicist leaders in Washington find that document to be incredibly important and helpful. They see patients every day able to walk through that document, engage their family members so that we don't get to a place when folks are facing difficult decisions where mother and daughter and husband and wife are on different pages. They've been able to have that conversation. Those values and desires are memorialized in a document that everyone can understand. And it reduces the kind of conflict that can exist in that moment and redirects everyone towards supporting decisions and being able to kind of accept what may be a difficult decision and moment in folks' lives and really enable folks to embrace their loved ones and move forward in a way that's positive for the patient and honors their decisions. And it's certainly helpful on the ground, again, for our ethicists, for our clinicians, for our mission leaders. We don't believe that prescribing any one approach and statute is appropriate. What we do know about advanced care planning is that this is an evolving field of practice, and the best thing that we can do to enable Oregon to stay at the forefront is to enable the Oregon Health Authority to continue to have these conversations over time, to enable a process to identify a good model, and to allow that model to change as best practice evolves. And that's what the Dash 2 amendments do, and to really bring everyone around the table to have that conversation. We really want to thank you for considering this issue. For those of us who are working on the ground with patients, with families, trying to honor wishes, to encourage folks to have these conversations well in advance of any event that would cause us to need to act on those wishes, we believe that Senate Bill 193 will help us do that in a more effective way. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. So let's see, Hillary Newcomb and Jeffrey Cheney. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Przanski and members of the Judicial Committee, good morning and thank you for hearing this important issue. My name is Hillary Newcomb. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I practice in estate planning, trust administration, and specialize in fiduciary litigation. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar, the section committee with the Trust and Estate Planning Section. And I'm speaking in opposition to the bill. When we draft estate planning documents for our clients and we have issues arise, we are helping these families with completion and execution and the fiduciaries following through with these legal forms. And so we are very closely involved with families implementing end of life, incapacity, and post-death or at death issues. We are attorneys who specialize in fiduciary law. And the healthcare directive form is part and parcel to a complete and comprehensive estate plan. So it's a form we educate our clients about. It is a form that we assist the agent in following through with, and things of that nature involving end of life, incapacity, et cetera. We too agree that this form is outdated, it is confusing, it is incomplete, arguably. It's problematic, and we are commonly approached by members of the bar that they would like to see it updated. They would like to see it more clearly addressed and not as confusing for us and for our clients. So we are definitely on the same page in that regard. However, knowing this, we have been proactive for some time in trying to implement a very broad-based work group, and that began by me communicating with various professionals January, February of last year. So we compiled a work group with our executive committee that was very broad in scope, because we are very sensitive to this being a very controversial, multifaceted area, combining legal, medical, ethics. It's been a controversial issue. It remains that, more or less. And so our work group was compiled with that in mind in order to go to the Oregon Law Commission. So at that time, that progress and momentum was stopped in favor of a judicial committee, the Elder Abuse Committee, I believe, to take that on, which they desired to do at that point, I believe. And I think that has since subsided. But we are very willing and able to come to the table, and we believe we have a lot to offer in regards to this legal document and implementing it with our clients in the estate planning arena, and yet that has not occurred as of yet. Or I should say it's maybe just beginning to occur now. For example, it was only in February of this year, 2015, that we became aware of Senate Bill 193. It was only on April 6th that our members became aware of Dash 2, the amendment. So we are very willing and able to come to the table and collaborate. We seek that out. That's what we really desire to do, and collaborate, communicate. I'm hearing that, which is very positive. We're encouraged by that. But until that can happen, and happen with the appropriate parties coming to the table and thoroughly analyzing and going through the work group process instead of backwards fashion, we oppose Senate Bill and Dash 2 Amendment. Thank you for your time today.
All right, thank you. Senator Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I'm an attorney who primarily handles estate planning and estate administration in Portland, Oregon. I'm also the immediate past chair of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section, and I'm here today to speak on behalf of attorneys in that section who are doing estate planning for their clients as well as for the estate planning section. There's 1,185 attorneys who belong to the estate planning section who are involved with their clients in some form of the advance directive. And we share the interests and concerns of the proponents of this legislation in that the advance directive is a document that needs to be corrected and changed. I think where we differ, and to that extent our opposition is we kind of differ in the approach of how to get there. And I think there definitely needs to be a deliberative process, more so than has occurred to date, with all of the stakeholders that are involved. Right now, the proponents are pretty heavily involved in stakeholders of the medical side, but hasn't yet picked up the stakeholders who would be outside of the medical arena. And there's an elder law section, there's a health section of the Oregon State Bar that probably would have some interest in participating in this. The Dash 22 amendments are a step in the right direction, because part of our concern is that if we need a new advance directive, then let's adopt a legislative path that will get us there and do so, and don't throw the old advance directive out until we have a new one to replace it with. And so that's the direction we're suggesting. It may be highly appropriate for the Senate Judiciary Committee to appoint a work group to facilitate this, because there's been three or four different groups that have sort of started the process and haven't completed it. Specifically with regard to the Dash 2 amendments, Section 7 does identify some stakeholders, and I think the ones who are identified there are definitely people who should be at the table. But I think there's some other stakeholders that need to be brought into, added to that program. The Rules Advisory Committee that's set to start on to begin a program by January 1st, 2017, seems like that should have an earlier start date, to give them 6 months to put together the advanced directive program is probably not enough time. And the other Section 18 of the bill seems to say, or says specifically, that the repeal of ORS 127-531 of this section does not invalidate any advanced directive executed before the effective date of this act. As I understand, if this act, if Dash 2 amendments were passed, they would be effective January 1st of 2016. So now what do you do with advance directives that are executed on the old form after January 1st of 2016, but before whenever the new thing emerges? So I think we're kind of getting... this is a good plan. I think that we need to address the advance directive, but throwing the old one out before we get a new one is not the best decision. And for that reason, we do oppose the Dash 2 as it's currently put forth, and we're available for questions.
Well, thank you. Questions from anyone? All right, so this is what I'm thinking we're going to end up doing. I appreciate the testimony we've heard from both sides, and Senator Cruz had a brief conversation, and we've had it with counsel as well. We think this is the right approach in the sense of moving forward. The Dash 2s is a great beginning point. Tom, I appreciate you all putting that together. It is a little late in the process. If we'd had that Dash 2s at the beginning of this session or prior to that, we might be able to accomplish something for this session. This is very important. We want to make sure we do it right, and we want to make certain that we cover all the issues that may not be unintended consequences. And so at this point, what I'm going to be suggesting is that we, the Judiciary Committee, will take on this as a work group project. The directive here is that we have a starting point with the dash twos. I understand they're not perfect, but they're a framework of kind of where I think does the intent is to not throw out the old and allow those to be effective and make certain you have a transition. So for us to do the work that I think we need to do, we need to have this group start meeting pretty quickly in the sense of whatever time it takes to get enough people together that need to be at the table, because we will want to have this addressed in the 2016 session. So basically, we complete our work in the end of June. I don't know, maybe the worker bees, in the sense of all the people that have come here today, can start meeting on their own. I cannot and will not charge my staff to start working during the session, or I will not be here.
No, that would be me.
So, but seriously, if y'all want to start meeting and start working out, it sounds like maybe just with having the dash twos out there, it's opened up some discussions and some suggestions. Our goal will be that we will want something, I'm going to say, in the fall of this year, so we can have enough time to actually have it presented to the one of the interim committee meetings. Will be September or November is what I'm thinking. Yeah. September, because I think the next one will be, so that's the goal. We'd like to have something back by September so we can look at it. That way we can work into the drafting phase that we need to do for legislative council, and we can then be ready to move forward in 2016. So other comments?
I think that sums it up, Mr. Chair. I think, I fully appreciate estate planning. That's a universe in and of itself. This is an offshoot of that, and I mean, I know that my folks with their estate planning, it took a long time to get there, okay, and I fully appreciate that, and you damn well better have a lawyer there. It's not going to be right, but the advance directive, I would like to have something that is understandable by normal people. Not that lawyers aren't normal, although I'm not sure. Well, lay people. There we go. Okay. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping we come up with is something that is easily understandable and relatively simple for people to make decisions that's impacting their own lives. So.
Well, it also seems like we have other examples around the the country, 42 states, if I heard that correct. Right. And I will say that I was in a situation where I was with an individual that had to check in a hospital, and they handed them an advance directive packet. And I'm looking at this going like, what is this for? You know, knowing what the injury, what needed to be done, and knowing what that form actually involved, it did get pushed to the side. And, you know, the people. So this would be something that I think would be a great project and be something that would be very beneficial for Oregonians.
Yep, absolutely.
Jeffrey?
Chair Przanski, one other aspect of the advance directive that sort of lingers out there is I believe the current statute does allow the medical hospitals and facilities to treat the advance directive as if it were a medical power of attorney. But there's a little bit of a gap there in terms of, I mean, people can go to the hospital and be unconscious and have to have someone make health care decisions for them, but their life, you know, is not terminal. They're not at end of life, and we may be able to help create something that kind of covers that situation as well.
That sounds like a good approach and a healthy discussion to have. So thank you all very much. I should ask before we went into this, was there anyone else who wanted to testify today on 193? Not seeing anyone coming forward. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 193. And our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today is Senate Bill 363.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 363 is a Judiciary Committee bill. The underlying bill prohibits courts and parties to a proceeding from charging or collecting a fee unless it is expressly authorized by law. You have the proposed dash one amendments, which replace the measure, and it prohibits the DA from charging a defendant for performing duties associated with processing fingerprints for an order to set aside a conviction or record of arrest. We have the fiscal back on the dash ones. It is minimal, and there's no revenue impact.
All right. And Gail, you're here.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This truly, truly is a simple bill. As originally drafted, the original bill was actually had many tentacles of consequences. So we're abandoning the original bill. Do not worry about the original bill. The Nash one would be the bill. And as counsel indicated, what it does is it expressly prohibits a prosecuting attorney from charging the defendant a fee as a condition of performing duties under the expungement statute. The district attorney really isn't in a position to prevent an expungement petition from moving forward. And the reason I say that is the motion doesn't get jump-started with the court itself. First, the defendant has to submit paperwork to the prosecuting attorney for them to review. That includes fingerprint cards that have to be moved forwarded to the Oregon State Police, an $80 check payable to the Oregon State Police, and all that stuff needs to get sent down to the Oregon State Police for them to do a records check. In the event it comes back positive, I mean, you know, okay, then the proceedings can move forward in a court of law. There's two fees that this legislative body has authorized in the expungement proceedings. One is the $80 check payable to the Oregon State Police. The other one is a filing fee. The filing fee is $252. It can be waived by the court, and they can set up structured payments. What we're understanding has happened is that there's a handful of counties, less than 10, but at least that many, about 8 or 9, that require the defendant to also independently pay to the district attorney's office a fee in exchange for them performing duties under the statute. They call it a processing fee. So this fee ranges in the amount of $40 to $100, and it's all over the map. None of these fees are authorized by the legislative body. It violates what we think is a pretty basic premise, that a party or state agency cannot impose a fee unless it's approved and authorized by this legislative body. So the purpose of the bill is to simply expressly disallow prosecuting attorneys from charging this fee. Quite frankly, this is truly an access to justice issue. Folks who are trying to move on with their life following a conviction or an arrest generally are struggling at best to get their toehold in. And so this can truly be something that can delay or, if not outright, eliminate them from viability. Support of the bill comes from Sponsors, Inc. and Mercy Corps Northwest, two reentry councils, Oregon Law Center, and the Washington County Reentry Council.
Questions? So, Gail, remind me, I know we looked at this as to having something a little bit broader instead of just dealing with the expungement. Remind me, refresh my memory, why we chose not to just make a blanket statement that if they're not fees imposed or authorized to be set at a agency level, why we didn't go there.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I mean, Chair... Again! It's just we're on the House side. Chair Prezonsky. Thank you for that. So, two things. There is another fee that's coming at the defense that's also what we term unauthorized. Courts are imposing fees on defendants in DUI diversion cases as a condition of reimbursing ADISs, the assessment people, for monitoring the negative reports coming out of ignition interlock devices. It was our understanding that that issue was going to be handled through legislation. Okay. With respect to the original bill, fees unauthorized by legislation cannot be imposed. There's a lot of fees, it turns out. And what we were opening up was the discussion of discovery. And the discovery, the costs of discovery when the government gives their discovery packet over to the defense, it's a huge issue, Chair Prezonsky. It is, because what's going on is we used to get paid per page, 10, 15 cents per page. Now we're getting charged per CD. All you need, $25 a CD, all you need is a redundancy of 8 CDs, and you're up to $200 for something that probably would have cost you $45 if you were paying per page. So that was a big thing we would be opening up, and we weren't prepared to deal with it.
All right. Thank you for the reminder. Other questions or comments? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So is there anyone else who wants to testify today on Senate Bill 363? Not seeing, we're going to close the public hearing. And are you ready to go for a work session? We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 363.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 363.
All right, Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment into Senate Bill 363. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, move Senate Bill 363 as amended by the -1 amendment to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 363 as amended by the -1s to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And anyone interested in carrying this? Or Senator Thatcher?
Sure.
Senator Thatcher will be our carrier on Senate Bill 363. All right, so I believe that takes care of our work for today. And we're scheduled for 8 o'clock tomorrow. And I think tomorrow will be a little busier day. We have a number of things on there. So
one or two.
Just one or two. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow. Thank you.